Health and Human Services Committee to order. Apologize for being a little bit late this morning. We're still waiting for a couple of members, but I think we may have a quorum already, so thank you for that, members. And we're going to continue to hear from the Department of Human Services with respect to the governor's budget proposals. We've been working through this, we'll see how far we get today. If we don't complete the overview today, we will continue on Friday morning. So at this time, I'd like to invite our testifiers from the department, if they are here. I hope. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Scott Leitz, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. I'm joined by Dave Greenman, also from the department. Mr. Chair, my understanding is that I think members have a one-pager of our base forecast for MA and Minnesota Care, and we'd be happy to walk through that as a starting point.
Members, I think you should have a one-page sort of a spreadsheet. Is this it?
That's correct.
Okay. Yes, we have that.
Members, it was our understanding from previous presentations that you received from DHS that you expressed some desire to have some sense of where we're starting from in terms of our base budget and that our proposals are working off of. And so we developed this proposal, and it's obviously a very high level. It doesn't go into a lot of detail, but it focuses. What we tried to do is focus on our basic health care spending, which is our acute care spending, not the long-term care portion of our budget. What we pulled together was for the top portion is looks at our Minnesota care spending. It divides it out between families with children and adults without children, and it goes through last biennium and the current biennium, which is fiscal years 10 and 11, and then our base forecast for fiscal years 12 and 13. We also look at the average monthly enrollment during that period as well for both families with children and Minnesota Care adults without kids. And then we show the change between the biennia. We do the same for the medical assistance program. We have it split out three ways, elderly and disabled, basic care, families with children and adults, the non-elderly, non-disabled adults that for which eligibility started yesterday. One of the things I wanted to point out in terms of looking at the change between biennia is because we received enhanced federal match for the last several, at least the last couple of years, and that ends June 30th of 11, it does sort of create a bit of an artificial large increase in our spending between 12 and 13 and 10 and 11, and the reason for that, part of the reason for that at least, is the enhanced federal match. And so on the far right, we show the enhanced the savings that the state actually got from the enhanced match in 10 and 11. And that, if you look at the change between biennia for the MA program, that accounts for more than half of the change between 10 and 11 and 12 and 13 is the enhanced federal match we received.
What you're calling the enhanced federal FMAP is that's the one-time money that was brought to the state under the stimulus plan. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Just members, just so that you understand, that's I believe that was paying for the what should have been or under normal circumstances would have been the state matching component of the medical assistance program that temporarily was being paid for by the stimulus dollars. Is that essentially right?
Mr. Chair, what the federal law provided that states that normally all states have basically have a federal match, and they qualify for it based on a number of factors. It's a formula-based federal match. Ours has been 50%. Minnesota's has been 50-50 under the federal federal law. We received an enhanced match. In other words, it was above 50%, so that held state spending down. And so that's what these numbers are representing.
And that was just a one-time deal?
That's correct.
Right. The other thing I'd like to ask you, just for some explanation, you've got, and I appreciate this, it's very helpful, you've got on the upper half the Minnesota Care. You've got some data on enrollment that shows going across some fairly significant growth in the MinCare family portion, and I'd like to ask you to comment on that. What is driving that that growth? And then you also have the Minnesota Care adults without children declining, and obviously down below we talk about medical assistance, some significant growth in the adult portion of the medical assistance basic care from 18,000 to 105,000. I'm assuming part of that is reflecting some shifting from Minnesota Care, but there are other things involved. Could you give us a little bit more detail of what is driving those enrollment numbers?
I could, and I believe if you haven't already gotten a forecast update from Mr. Hoffman, he can probably go into much more detail about the forecast changes. I don't know if you're going to be receiving one for the February forecast or not.
I have not seen that. I'm just asking our fiscal analyst if he's seen it.
Mr. Chair?
We have not seen that. Perhaps that would be something we should request Mr. Hoffman to come to the committee and maybe walk us through that. But I have not seen those things.
Senator Burgum.
Mr. Chairman, because we have so many new people on the committee, I just wanted to remind everybody that the enhanced Medicaid match that we received from the federal government through the Stimulus Act benefited every area of the budget. It did not just benefit the Health and Human Services area. It was treated by finance as a block grant to the state. It reduced the budget deficit, and it was used in every area of the budget to reduce cuts that otherwise would have had to be made.
Senator Berglund, you're right. Thank you for that. And I believe it was something, the total was over $2 billion, but a lot of it ended up in this budget area, I believe, over $1.5 billion of that total money,
well,
wasn't that?
Mr. Chairman, the spending would show up here, but the use of the money in regard to the budget deficit benefited every area of the budget.
Yep, I understand. Thank you for that. Mr. Greenman, do you have anything you can enlighten us on in terms of the numbers, absent a presentation from Mr. Hoffman, which we will try to secure? But
Mr. Chair, I can talk in general terms about where we're seeing enrollment, some potential reasons for the enrollment growth. I mean, we are seeing a big increase in Minnesota Care families. I think there's a number of factors. Obviously, the economy is a driver. There had been a federal COBRA subsidy that families could qualify for, and there was also a state component to that. That has ended. We are able to process applications more quickly recently, and that's gotten more people through the pipeline. So I can't pinpoint one particular reason why it's going up, and it's possible that Mr. Hoffman and his staff may have a more precise reason, but those are some of the reasons why I think we are seeing an increase.
But thank you, and I think we'll try to see, actually, if we meet on Friday, we'll see if Mr. Hoffman is available to come in and give us a little more detail. But is it fair to say that some of the growth on the medical assistance enrollment, some of those people were the result of the expanded early enrollment that the governor exercised a month or so ago, that people who were previously not insured under Minnesota Care or the previous medical assistance program, is that correct?
That's correct. I think it's much of the enrollment, Mr. Chair, for adults without kids, it represents people coming over from Minnesota Care and GAMC, but there is a number of people, 12,000 strikes me as being the number, who are coming from the uninsured ranks, who we're assuming.
Well, thank you for this. This is helpful information, and we appreciate it. Mr. Lice?
Mr. Chair, first page we would start with is page 59, federal compliance related to program integrity. This item is a federal compliance issue. The Deficit Reduction Act and the Federal Patient Protection and Accountable Care Act extended two programs that were intended to really bring some additional oversight and tools to state Medicaid agencies to help fight fraud and abuse. The first is the Medicaid Integrity Program, and the second is what's called the Recovery Audit Contract. This item asks for some funding to be able to implement those two pieces of legislation from the federal level. The Medicaid Integrity Program is really focused on preventing and reducing provider fraud, waste, and abuse in the Medicaid program. We do this through audits of CMS contracts to identify overpayments and then go after those overpayments to ensure that we are doing our due diligence in that area. The second program, the Recovery Audit Program, state Medicaid agencies are given authority and required to contract with on a contingency basis to conduct provider audits to recover overpayments and identify under collections in the program. And so what's being requested here is the ability to actually implement those two pieces. There is a compliance piece here on the that relates to the way that the state does our accounting. Under procurement statutes, we have to on the contingency basis piece of this, would be required to enter into contracts with on a contingency basis. For us to actually pay those, contracts aren't valid under state law unless there's an encumbrance. But since we don't know the amount that's going to be recovered, it's impossible for us in advance to know what that encumbrance amount is. And so we're requesting a change to state law to allow us to retain funds to be able to pay that contingency fee outside of the way that's currently structured.
Thank you. I assume that there are programs in place beyond these that the department is exercising to try to manage the false claims or fraudulent. I seem to recall fairly recently there was a significant, I think, $1 million claim of fraudulent practice that was uncovered. And what is the department's ongoing procedure in dealing with potential fraud or managing that? Is that beyond what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chair, we do have a standing ongoing work that is occurring in this area. We have a unit which is called CSRS, which does a lot of the investigatory work around provider payments and those sorts of things. The federal pieces here simply put in place some additional tools for the department to use in addition to what we're already doing. This is a focus area that the department's going to be working on quite heavily in the coming year. So you'll be hearing, I think, more from us on this. And what this does is really strengthen our tools to be able to do additional work in this area.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 61, coverage for dental therapists. The 2009 legislature passed into law the establishment of two new mid-level dental providers in the state. And the goal here was to allow for alternative or additional ways for basic dental services to be delivered to Medicaid and other clients that have traditionally been delivered only by a dentist. The dental therapist and the advanced dental therapists will beginning to start to graduate from their programs. We anticipate 6 to 8 graduates per year coming out of programs to deliver these services. What this budget page does is give authorization to the department to establish billing codes for these particular providers so that they can begin to offer services.
So this is not covering the costs of the services. This is what, an administrative cost that needs to be?
Mr. Chair, the budget request here would be the request to cover the cost of the services provided by those practitioners. So there will be some reduction in cost because clients will be seeing providers who aren't dentists, and therefore there'll be more efficiency in terms of the services being provided at a lower cost. However, we do expect that there'll be an expansion of services, meaning more people will actually have access to the services, which is why this shows up as a net cost in the budget.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Leitz, with these type of routine services that the dental high advanced practice folks will be providing, what kind of percentage reduction would there be in the cost of, say, a typical visit to a dental provider that's provided by this.
Mr. Leitz?
Senator Marty, the reimbursement for, there's two levels of these mid-level providers. There's the advanced dental therapist. Their reimbursement would be approximately 90% of what a dentist would receive. And there's the regular dental therapists, and their reimbursement would be about 65% of what a dentist would receive.
So just so I understand, so what we're saying is that I remember a couple of years ago, we created this expanded or this additional category of providers, and the argument was that they could do things at a lower cost. And you're saying that's true, but because we're doing more things, it's actually an increase in cost to the overall MA budget. Is that essentially correct?
Mr. Chair, in a sense, that is correct. We're providing a broader access to dental services than we currently have. And as a result of more people having that access, even though on a per unit basis, it's a lower cost way of doing it. I think it's important to remember that with dental services, this is a chronically underserved area for our population. So, yeah, the modest cost increase is a result of that.
Senator Bergman?
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Leitz, was there any credit given for the expanded access to having lower emergency room visits? Because we have quite a few emergency room visits as a result of lack of access to dental care for many of our clients.
Mr. Leitz?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I don't know the answer to that right today. We'll check on that and see whether that was included in the analysis with regards to the fiscal cost.
Thank you. That's a good point. Appreciate that. And Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, on that point, yeah, I think, Senator Berger, I think it's like 22,000 emergency room visits a year for dental, so it could be a huge type of impact on emergency rooms.
I seem to recall that was part of the discussion we had, that this would help
reduce
that,
some of that. Yeah.
And we would hope that that would be reflected in the budget proposal.
We'll examine that.
Thanks. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 62, the Electronic Health Records Incentive Payment Program. The American Recovery and Act put in place an incentive program called the High Tech Act, which was intended to provide financial incentives for hospitals and providers to adopt and then meaningfully use electronic health records, with a goal of providing the right sort of information to clinicians at the point of care to ensure that they have accurate and correct and up-to-date information on the patients that they're seeing, and to be able to exchange that information with patient consent for the purposes of treatment. Hospitals and clinics are eligible under this program if they meet certain thresholds. The program itself is 100% federally funded for the incentive payment portion of it. There's a Medicare portion. Those payments are going out and administered by the federal government through the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, or CMS. State Medicaid agencies have responsibility for implementing the Medicaid incentive payments, which flow out. And so what this budget item requests is funding for the state implementation of this program. The funding itself is for the implementation piece is split 90% federal, 10% state. So the funding that's being requested here is really that 10% state portion. These payments will go out statewide to providers who meet thresholds of Medicaid business. I believe it's 30% of your business at a clinic site must be medical assistance for you to qualify for these payments, 10% at a hospital level to qualify for these payments, and they go out over a series of years to providers.
These records that are going to be maintained, is this data that is currently being collected by the department, or is this new data?
Mr. Chair, to be really clear on this is not any data that the department or any department would be collecting. This would be information on patients' medical records that would be held by providers. And what the program here is to allow hospitals and clinics to move from a paper-based system of how they currently maintain that information into an electronic health record. And then for them to be able to use that information for the treatment of patients. So nothing here creates any sort of data at the department, at any of the departments in the state.
Are there issues with data privacy attendant to this? Is this something that needs to be – I was on the Judiciary Committee a few years ago, and I know these kinds of issues were very prominent in that committee. Is this something that needs to be examined by the Judiciary Committee as well?
Mr. Chair, what would be doing here would be actually putting in place grant programs for providers to work under the current law as it currently exists in Minnesota. So nothing here changes anything with regards to what's occurring with regards to electronic health records. Most providers have already adopted these. This is incentive programs for them to be able to better use that information for the purposes of treatment. So nothing here changes any of the current rather robust state privacy laws that exist around the exchange of information with patient consent.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 64, and this is a change item to establish develop and establish a streamlined eligibility determination system for our public programs in Minnesota. The federal government is providing an opportunity for states through the end of 2015 to receive a 90% match to develop and install eligibility determination systems that will provide a easier and more helpful front end for eligibility determination for our public programs. A lot of that work is currently being done at the county level. We work out of two systems right now for our eligibility programs. One is called MAXIS, and the other is called MMIS. And those systems are older and somewhat complicated to work with within the scope of what the counties do when they do enrollment. One of those systems really does our medical assistance determination. The other system does our Minnesota Care eligibility determination, as well as some of our payment. And so those systems, if you talk to any county worker, they will tell you that determining which system to use and working between the two can be challenging. It involves paper-based systems that sometimes involve data entry into the system. What we're requesting funding to be able to do here is really to build a much more streamlined eligibility front end to those systems so that we can more rapidly, with more accuracy, and in a more streamlined fashion, allow counties to be able to do that eligibility determination, hopefully make the system a more efficient one, and also enable us to start to build towards the future in terms of how our eligibility systems will have to interchange with any changes that might be coming down the pike in the next several years related to health insurance exchanges or other types of systems that might be developed for implementation of various reforms.
What is the federal dollars associated with this? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, the funding is split. The match that's being requested here would be a 10% state match. So the federal funding portion would be nine times, I guess, the amount on the pages. 22.5 million, I understand from Mr. Green.
And is this a... I know there was recently the governor had requested some funding from the federal government with respect to the health insurance exchange implementation. Is this a part of that funding, or is this separate?
Mr. Chair, this is separate from that funding. The grant that the state I think requested and has now received with regards to the health insurance exchange was really about doing the planning to be able to move forward on that system. This is actually for us to, on the ground, implement an eligibility system. We believe it will work. It's necessary work for it to actually dovetail with the exchange as that comes into play, but this is going to be necessary regardless of that.
Any questions? Please continue.
Mr. Chair, next page is page 65, and it's a change item on managed care reforms. The state has used various managed care arrangements over time to deliver health care services to our Medicaid populations, both our acute care and long-term care populations, through our health care programs. The contracts that we have in place with managed care plans require certain things, and what we're proposing here is a series of reforms to those, both to those contracts as well as how we do some of the contracting overall with the plans. There's really four items that relate to this. The first is to establish a clinical performance target within our managed care contracts. We currently do withholds within our managed care contracts where a portion of the money that we pay on a capitated basis is withheld from plans And then they have certain performance targets related to clinical outcomes as well as some administrative pieces that they're required to meet in order to have that money paid back. We're adding an additional one here, which would be focused on reducing hospital readmission rates. This is an area where, with proper management of care after people leave the hospital, we can significantly, we believe, reduce the number of people who actually end up back in the hospital for a condition that otherwise they had initially been in for. What the target that's being established here in the governor's budget proposal would be to have a reduction of 30-day hospital readmission rates of 5% per year over a series of 5 years, or until a overall rate reduction of 25% relative to the 2010 rate is hit.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Leitz, does that mean that you'll withhold the 5% for 5 years so that they have to reach the 25% or the 5% a year for 5 years? Does that mean you withhold it for 5 years?
Mr. Leitz?
Mr. Chair, and just to clarify, Senator Higgins, the withhold right now is 5% that's paid back on a series of measures.
Yeah.
As you hit the various measures, there's payback for each of those measures, I believe, is how we currently do that. This would be an additional piece to that. So the 5% that's being withheld, there would be, depending on which of the measures is hit, and this one would now be included, there would be payback based on which of those measures is hit. So I wanted to clarify that piece. To your question, which is it withheld for 5 years, the answer to that is that we would be paying back on an annual basis.
That's correct.
Those pieces. And then after the five-year period, we would also be examining whether the aggregate 25% had been hit, and there would be a payback if that piece had been hit as well. So there would still be a payback on an annual basis on the 5% piece if that's met on an annual basis.
So, Mr. Chair, at the end of 5 years, if you don't meet your goal, then do the hospitals pay you back then? Or how would that work?
I'm not sure if this is going to answer your question, but what we would do is at the end of – we would continue to require them to try to hit the target until at the end of the five-year period. If they haven't hit it, then they don't get part of that annual reimbursement back. I would imagine we would continue to have them try to hit their 5% target until they do so.
Okay. And
Senator Higgins?
No.
Was there another question? Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out that it shouldn't really be so hard for the hospitals to meet this target, since Minnesota is twice as high in rehospitalizations as Wisconsin. And even at this target, instead of being 100% higher, we would be only 50% higher. Mr. Chairman, while I have the floor here, I'd like to just ask if there's a breakdown of the cost or savings for each of these four items on this budget page.
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, we can provide that.
Thank you.
That would be helpful. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I also think that not to that one, to the hospital admission thing through the health plans, but I note I've had a bill on terms of – introduced a bill on terms of the hospital – the contracting with the health plans. And you know that several House members put in one that they thought we could cut the reimbursement rate to the plans by 15%, which is like $600 million. And I think the department is perhaps scratching the surface of this issue.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Leitz?
Mr. Chair, the other elements of this particular item really relate to the first the second one being the establishment of a competitive price bidding pilot project for our managed care contracts in the Twin Cities metro area. Currently, we establish rates based on history in those programs, and also make those contracts available to plans who meet certain standards of participation. What we would be proposing here would be to establish a pilot program which would require plans to, instead of accepting a rate, bid a price for the contracts in order to receive them. And then we would be, based on that, selecting a smaller number of plans to serve the area for the portion of the business that we'd be doing the bidding in, which is our families and children program. And it would be, as proposed by the governor, in the 7-county metro area. Third item, Mr. Chair, is to reduce the maximum amount of the capitation payments that which is paid to managed care organizations that they can use for administrative expenses from the current cap, which is 6.6%, down to a cap of 5.3%. And then the final item would be a reduction in the rates paid in the capitation rates paid to managed care organizations of 2.75%.
Mr. Lights, just to question the reduction of administrative expenses, 6.6 to 5.3%, those are fairly precise. Why 5.3 and not 5.2 or 4? Was that an arbitrary number, or was that arrived in some way?
Mr. Chair, it was a rate that we felt would put additional put additional incentives in place for the managed care plans to effectively manage their administrative portions of the business while also making sure that we were paying sufficiently to cover the costs in the programs of their administration.
So you don't know how they arrived at 5.3 precisely rather than some other number?
Mr. Chair, I believe that it was arrived at by that combination of art and science that got us to that figure of where we felt that we could sort of put that additional pressure without pushing it further than we should.
Senator Brugler.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Lights, these areas, both the administrative and non-administrative side of the managed care contracts, must meet actuarial soundness. So I'm assuming the 5.3% would meet an actuarial soundness standard for the administrative expenses that your actuary has decided we could reduce that and it would still be actuarially sound?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, yes.
So, Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Lights, if there was another way to reduce administrative costs, then that would be on top of the 5.3. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, that would be correct. This is if something else in addition to this proposal were to pass, it would be on top of that.
And Mr. Chairman, Assistant Commissioner Lights, the 2.75% for the non-administrative payments also has to be actuarially sound. So has your actuary certified that this rate would still be actuarially sound and that these plans would not be passing this rate cut on to providers in terms of a provider payment cut?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, we do believe this would meet the actuarial soundness piece. The pass-through that you mentioned is not addressed in this particular page, however.
Mr. Chairman. Assistant Commissioner Lights, will it be addressed in your bill when you have it introduced?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, we will. We are still making determinations on that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
And Assistant Commissioner Lights, I would encourage you to do so because, as you know, you have another page coming up that will be a rate cut. And if we're going to do a rate cut, then we should just put it all on the rate cut page. And if this is not intended to be a rate cut, then you should make sure that it's not passed through.
Mr. Lights, just to clarify, the actuarial soundness of can you clarify, have these proposals been vetted with the actuaries and they have determined that these are the numbers that are sound, or is this something that is going to happen, and or just what? Just give us a little more detail on what the
Mr. Chair, as we put together the proposals, this item we viewed as being one which would bring some additional efficiencies to the work that we do. As proposed, we believe it will meet the actuarial soundness test. Where we can't make determinations with definity is the fact that we don't know all the other changes that are going to occur within the budgetary process. And so moving forward, our package as put together in the governor's budget would do that from a soundness perspective. What we are uncertain on is obviously this will go through a process at the legislature. There will be proposals from any number of other people which will have impacts. We won't know until the end of that process how those will impact on actuarial soundness, but as it stands now, we have a package which we believe does that.
So just to be clear, that this then hasn't really been examined by the actuaries, but it's the administration's belief that if they were to be, that they would be found to meet that criteria, and there's some expectation that that would happen as this proceeds in combination with whatever other things are involved.
Mr. Chair, I know conversations have occurred with the actuaries with regards to this. I don't think there has not been a certification to my knowledge of this.
Mr. Chairman?
Just one sec. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, on the administrative expenses, who's defining the administrative expenses, and how do we know the definitions between the plans are the same? I'm just curious how the department sees that.
Mr. Leitz?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Karen Pete. I'm the director for Managed Care.
Could you bring the microphone a little bit closer so that we can catch your name for the record?
My name is Karen Pete. I'm the Director for Managed Care Purchasing and Payment Policy at the Department of Human Services. There are some standards around reporting administrative expenses, but there has been a requirement made by last year's legislature for the Health Department to convene a work group to provide clarification and make recommendations about how administrative expenses be defined by the health plans that have the health plans and county-based purchasers that have contracts for Minnesota healthcare programs. That work group was required to meet to begin its process not later than December of 2010, and the work group has in fact met. Further work groups are scheduled, and I believe that the report is due to the legislature prior to the 2012 session. But we would believe that that would put the necessary consistency, make recommendations about the necessary consistency for reporting of administrative expenses.
Senator Berglund, did you have?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Pede. Do you remember sitting at a table like that last year and telling us that we couldn't reduce administrative expenses any more than we had, or it would not be actuarially sound?
Ms. Pete?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, I do recall expressing that concern. On the other hand, these are tough budget times, and if the administration wants us to try and make these reductions and achieve greater efficiency, we're certainly intent on doing that.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Pete, I'm not asking you what the administration wants you to do. And I'm certainly not asking you what they want you to do this year compared to last year. But I do find it very interesting that an actuarial standard can change based on a budget forecast. And I hope that isn't what's been happening here. But if it has, then I think we probably need to understand more about what goes into the actuarial standard.
Ms. Peter, Mr. Leitz, any?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I think we, when in putting together this package, we looked at what we considered to be doable under the current structure that we have. I can't speak to past what discussions were, but I can say that moving forward, this is kind of where we feel comfortable from a soundness perspective.
I think it would be helpful, and on the committee, I believe, has asked for some detail on these proposals, and I guess I would like to see that presented as how does this affect the care organizations, and these reductions, what does that look like in terms of dollars by organization? Or I'm still curious at how we arrived at 5.3%. That's a fairly exact number. And I understand that you're going through a process, and as I hear it, these things haven't fully been vetted by the actuaries, but that's an unusual number to choose out of and say, well, it's going to be 5.3 rather than 6.6, and I guess it's just unclear to me how we arrived at those numbers. And if you're just taking an arbitrary amount, I can understand that, setting a target and saying we're going to reduce it by that amount, but I think there needs to be a little more detail here of what we're doing and how we're doing it.
We can do that, Mr. Chair. Just on the, not to belabor the point of the 5.3, but I think what, again, I just wanted to sort of restate kind of where directionally we wanted to go with this, and that was to put in place additional incentives for administrative efficiencies at the plan level. I think what you'll see is it's about a 20% reduction from the 6.6 down to the 5.3. Was 20% the right number? You know, that at some point it is a decision that needs to be made, and it's somewhat, in that sense, arbitrary, but I think we felt that 20% was a reasonable amount of additional proportional reduction.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, on that, again, going back to who defines what's administrative and what's whatever, it's kind of a meaningless number anyway because they define it the way they want. I mean, within the standards, but I think there's a whole lot of flexibility, and some of us might define it a whole lot different.
Senator Marty, I understand that, and I guess if we can get a little more detail, it might help us to at least learn what we're talking about here. It's a little vague, but we'll work with it and see what you come up with here. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next item is on page 67. It's the evidence-based childbirth program. What we're recommending here is that an incentive program be established for hospitals to create and develop policies and quality programs with an aim towards eliminating elective inductions of labor before 39 weeks. We know that elective from the medical science that elective inductions have been associated with a lot of unintended consequences, including increased risk of acute and long-term complications for babies and a higher risk of complicated cesarean deliveries. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has recommended that elective inductions not be performed before 39 weeks of gestation. And the state, through its Health Services Advisory Committee, which the state statutorily established a number of years ago, looked at this issue, came back with a recommendation that we put in place some incentives, non-financial incentives for hospitals to put in place policies for them to actually reduce or eliminate elective inductions before 39 weeks. And so what this budget page looks at is how to do that, establishing those standardized processes putting in place processes for hospitals to put in place policies to eliminate those inductions, as well as some data reporting back to the department around the number of elective inductions and whether those hospitals have in place policies. If they don't have in place policies, there's a requirement that they submit a data form along with their birth claims. And it's basically what we're driving at here through an incentive system is for a reduction in the reporting requirements if you have a policy in place and more reporting requirements if you don't.
Numbers, and there seems to be some duplication in pages in your book, so I just
want
to make
sure.
There is,
Mr. Chair, and I apologize for
that. We were on page 65, and in the back of page 65 is page 59. Not quite sure how that happens. And then we go forward from there. I just want to make sure people are on the same page here. We went to page 67, I believe.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Are there questions?
Mr. Chairman, Assistant Commissioner Lights, so how many, I don't know if you want to tell me the answer in terms of numbers or percentage of inductions will be reduced as a result of this policy.
Mr. Lights or Mr. Greenman?
We may need to get back to you, Senator Brooks, with that.
Other questions? Senator Benson?
This is a standard of practice right now. Do you really think you're going to save that much money?
Mr. Leitz?
Mr. Chair, you're correct, Senator Benson, that a number of the hospitals have developed this sort of policy already. And what we have found, though, is that a number have not, and that there still is a fair number of inductions. And I think our own data would demonstrate that. We pay for about 38% of the births in the state through the Medicaid program, and I think our data indicate that there still are a number of these occurring. And so the goal here, again, is to really just put in place some policy, some encouragement of adoption of policies that will have further reductions in these.
Mr. Chair, the March of Dimes is already working on this. The College of Obstetrics and Gynecology is working on this. How long have they been working on it, and have we already seen some benefits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, and a number of those groups, and I would say most of those groups really worked with us on this proposal. It was a large table, and it was a really, I think, productive table to get to this budget proposal, and had a lot of the professional societies that work on this, as well as the advocacy groups who also are concerned about these issues, were all part of those discussions. We do believe that there has been some progress has been made already. We believe that additional progress certainly can be made and accelerated on it as well.
Hey, thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next proposal is on page, I believe it's on page 69. This proposal addresses our system for providing prior authorization on fee-for-service services. Right now, we pay for approximately 80,000 prior authorizations a year for services for which there's a service threshold that once a person hits that threshold, they need a prior authorization in order to continue to receive the services or to receive the services initially, depending on what the service is. We've had the current system in place for quite a while. It's a paper-based system where we pay a vendor a certain amount to do and provide them with information and ask them to make the review and determine whether prior authorization should be granted or not. That's a time-consuming proposal that's expensive for us, and frankly, there's a number of cases where it's a pretty straightforward question, and we probably don't need to necessarily go to a live person and have them do the actual authorization. What this proposal would do is make a number of changes to modernize the prior authorization system in the state. It would require use of electronic prior authorizations for most services in the state, effective March 1 of 2012. And it would also, in addition to changing the process, what it would also do is change the way it works so that people, to make it a bit more client-centered and a better experience for clients. Right now, if a person needs a certain number of is getting a certain type of treatment and they need a certain number of, they'll get a prior authorization for instance, 10 physical therapy visits or something like that. If later on their provider decides, well, they actually need something else like chiropractic or something, they have to get another prior authorization for that. What this would do is instead of having sort of one-time prior authorizations by service, they have the prior authorization would be for an episode of treatment. So that way the person doesn't have to go back out and get another prior authorization. In addition, it also follows the person. It isn't specific to the provider. So our goal in this is to reduce the need for unnecessary prior authorizations. For one thing, we're using an electronic system. We'll have build a computer system and have an algorithm in place so that instead of having to send a paper prior authorization to a vendor, we can just run it through a computer system to make a determination about what the prior authorization. That's much quicker for those that are more straightforward. For those that are complex, we'll still use the prior authorization system that we have, the paper process, and use our vendor for that. One of the other changes that this proposal makes is to our therapies. Right now, we pay for a specialized maintenance therapy service. We found that it's used by primarily 93% of our costs are go to one particular provider in the state that serves one specific location in the state. Most of the people being served are have a mental illness diagnosis, and we worked with our mental health section at DHS and made some determinations that these folks would probably be better, the people getting the service would probably be better served through a mental health system. They already are getting mental health services. They have access to PCAs as well. We felt that since the service is being paid for mainly just for one provider in one specific location in the state, that it made sense given the budget times to eliminate coverage for specialized maintenance therapy.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I struggle sometimes to stay with the nomenclature. Did I just hear you say that authorizations are going to be determined by a computer and not a human being?
Mr. Greenman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, in cases where where it's a fairly straightforward calculus that needs to be done, not calculus, but if it's a straightforward case of a person has a certain condition and their provider defines that condition and they need a prior authorization, it would go through an algorithm that can give them a quick prior authorization when they need it. There's also an appeals process if they feel like they haven't gotten the prior authorization they need. So this is essentially designed only for those very simple cases where it's a very straightforward decision.
Mr. Chairman, the answer to my question is yes?
Yes. Sorry, yes.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Newman.
Again, pardon my naivety. Do doctors get involved in this process?
Mr. Greenman?
I believe that, Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I believe the physician is involved in asking for the prior authorization on behalf of the patient.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Newman.
You believe they are or they are?
Well, I shouldn't say I believe they are. They are involved in doing it on behalf of their patients.
Senator Hoffman and then Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you define for me what is a simple procedure? I'm trying to see what the scope of this is.
Let me see.
Mr. Greenman.
There's somebody here who can do that. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Julie Marquardt. I am the Deputy Director of the Health Services and Medical Management Division at DHS. Your question regarding what would be a straightforward, for instance, we have algorithms already developed and are actually in the process of being tested for like a high-tech image like an MRI of the head. If someone, it's an expensive service that we don't want to just let everybody have an MRI. So what will happen is if the provider comes in and says, I have a patient that I believe needs an MRI, we may ask them, does the person have a history of trauma? That may be a clear indicator. It's a quick, yep, okay, they had a car accident. They had something happen that is immediately screaming out, this is an appropriate service to have an MRI. And they quickly get an answer, yes, and they proceed on with the appropriate care. Things that require more complex decision-making would be reserved for the medical providers to look through the medical record, make a decision based on the clinical information whether or not that service is indeed medically necessary.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're not talking about an emergency situation where somebody presents to the ER and they need an MRI for whatever reason. Maybe they had a car accident 20 years ago, and maybe that has nothing to do with it. Maybe they have high blood pressure. Maybe they have a bleed in their head. I'm not really...
Mr. Chair, yeah, these do not apply in the emergency room situation.
Okay.
Senator Berglund?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the last part of this recommendation is that physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech-language pathology always be subject to a prior authorization. And so my question is, this new authorization system, the one we have now takes so long to get a prior authorization when somebody needs more physical therapy than the limit allows, that they oftentimes regress back to the position they were in when they started therapy in terms of their mobility. And they're starting all over again then to get this person back into a mobile situation. So how long is it going to take to get a prior authorization for a first or second or third time a person needs a physical therapy visit?
Ms. Marquardt?
Mr. Chair, that is actually one of the reasons why we are making this proposal, because we have had concerns about the timeliness of the decision-making. So the first episode, because we're not looking at the individual services anymore, providers actually today, there are providers who keep tick marks as to every, did I do an ultrasound, did I do manual therapy, because they were given approval to do 30 of these, 10 of these, and 5 of these. That gives them absolutely no flexibility to change the treatment plan, even if 3 weeks down the line they realize that they need a little more of this and a little less of this. Our system doesn't give them the flexibility to do that. By doing an episode of care, we can actually extend the period of time for the approval and give them the flexibility to use all of their tools for perhaps a 6-week period, if it's appropriate, a 6-month period. So we're hoping they don't have to interface with us as much, because those little changes, they do take time, and they're really, in a lot of cases, not necessary.
Well, Senator Burton. Mr. Chairman, that's good information to have, but that isn't the question that I asked you. I asked you, how long is it going to take to get a prior authorization through the system to start with? Let's just say, you know, my husband has had a stroke. He needs to get into physical therapy tomorrow. Is it going to take 2 weeks or a month or 2 months to get a prior authorization through, so that, you know, he doesn't get any physical therapy until this happens, and by the time he gets it, it might be too late?
Ms. Marquardt?
Mr. Chair, we have a requirement to respond within 10 days. Our hope is that we are coming in well under that. For something as straightforward as a new onset of a stroke, that shouldn't take more than a small number of days to get the medical records, find out that, yes, indeed, this person was hospitalized, they had a stroke, they have left side paralysis, whatever it is that's appropriate to treat. We should be able to give that person approval in a very short number of days. And quite honestly, in a situation like that, the provider can proceed and come back and ask for approval after they've started. Where the medical necessity is clear, they certainly have the ability to do that.
Mr. Chairman, just one last question then. What is being eliminated? What won't be approved that gets you the cost savings on this page?
Ms. Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, what this proposal eliminates is the service called specialized maintenance therapy. Most therapies, physical therapy, occupational, speech, are called what's called restorative therapy, meaning the patient has potential to improve. They have a defined deficit. They have a baseline that they have declined from, and the therapist is going to work to bring them back up to baseline, or if there's potential even beyond what their baseline was prior. Specialized maintenance therapy was actually developed to with the physically disabled in mind, but as Dave pointed out, it's really become a service that one provider is obtaining about $1.5 million per year billing this service. And if some of those services are restorative, they can and should be billed that way. If they are services that are redundant or duplicative of the mental health services or services of a PCA, or that we could transition to maintenance done by a PCA or a caregiver, we need to be doing that too. So it's the savings generated from that.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify then, you do not expect that anyone will be receiving fewer physical therapy, occupational therapy, or speech language pathology services than we have now, even though everybody has to go through prior authorization for their first visit.
Ms. Marquardt?
Mr. Chair, the proposal does actually include a small amount of savings that's generated from perhaps a decreased utilization. I don't think that the expectation on the restorative side is that people who are getting it now won't get it now. They may get less. our experience in looking at the data in services that go up to the authorization seem to indicate in across all three therapies that there's a sharp drop as soon as people are meeting the thresholds, which means that either remarkably everybody was okay as soon as they met the threshold, or something else is happening. Either they didn't quite need all those visits, but they did them anyway because they had approval, or they're confused about what the threshold means and they don't know they can ask for more, or they just stop. All of those situations aren't good. So by going to an approval from the outset, we actually think we'll improve that continuity of care. There'll be no incentive to work up to a maximum of a threshold. And sometimes, unfortunately, what happens with the threshold, too, is if there's a provider that's treated them in the past that submits their claims and a new provider doesn't know about them, when those claims come through, they actually use up the threshold. And then the new provider doesn't know that they've met the threshold until their claim denies. So it's really a very ineffective.
Thank you.
Ms. Marquardt, does the department keep track of what the history of prior authorizations, the time it takes to do this? Does the department track that? If we ask, would you be able to provide us how long does it take to get prior authorization for certain things? Or does the department have data on that?
Mr. Chair, yes and no. I would tell you that we do track. We have a medical review vendor that handles the authorizations. One of the benefits of the new system is to actually improve that our ability to know that a provider submitted, they sent their documentation on this date, our vendor made a determination on this date, they picked up the file out of the queue on this date, so that when providers tell us, why am I waiting 2 weeks for something that should have taken 3 days, we actually can go into the system and hold accountable our vendor if they are not meeting the timelines. Unfortunately, right now, the whole system is paper-based, and so faxes are going directly to our vendor, so we can't really, with any certainty, verify the date at which those were received, when requests back and forth may have been made for additional information. It's difficult for us to, with great certainty, verify.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, I think some of these prior authorization improvements may be improvements in terms of doing things computerized and so on. I think the fact that you're requiring it for the first, before they get the first service, I think Senator Berglund's concerns, I share those same concerns. I wanted to comment a minute on your specialized maintenance therapy, the one where you say you're saving the money, and I understand with the costs growing, as you say, 51% in 5 years, that that's something you want to look at carefully. But again, I don't know exactly what occupational therapy for people with mental health conditions is, but it seems to me you're saying in there that they also have PCA or home care services, which strikes me as very unrelated to occupational therapy. And what troubles me most is the last sentence, which suggests that we are not really sure what we're doing. If persons currently receiving specialized maintenance therapy services experience a decrease in their level of function, such that they require restorative therapy, we're going to be more responsive and jump to it. In other words, we're going to screw up their lives, and then we'll be more efficient in the restorative therapy. And I don't know. I mean, it just strikes me that something that's maintaining their level, even if it's not what we envisioned, and again, I don't know enough about this to comment whether it's very helpful or not, but saying that, well, you know, if we stop giving them maintenance therapy and then they fall down to a lower level, then their quality of life, their ability to function in society, their other costs to society may be greater in terms of, I don't know if they're working or not, but if we drop them to the point where they now need restorative therapy, I just think we may be spending more in the long run. I think this might be one of those short-sighted cuts.
Ms. Marquardt, any comment?
Mr. Chair, I think perhaps what might give you some peace of mind is the review that we did with our mental health, our adult mental health division. We were concerned about what it's approximately 450 people, adults that are getting this service now, and we really did want to make sure that if we remove this service, what was in place currently or what would be available. When we looked at the service, along with the folks from the mental health division, the conclusions that they drew, which were kind of premises that we suspected but certainly were not the experts in making the determination, their conclusions were that the primary diagnoses for which the occupational therapy services were being given, and occupational therapy is a specialty around activities of daily living. They're experts in that area. These are mental health diagnoses. These are psychoses that are being treated. And so the mental health division really felt like the provider, the service that is being performed, sometimes it was activities like baking cookies. It doesn't require the provider to have any knowledge or experience in working with individuals with serious mental illness. They also were concerned that the service doesn't reflect the department's emphasis on evidence-based practice. That role is not really a part of a recognized model. It doesn't require the staff to be trained in evidence-based practice approaches, which is something the mental health community has really strived and made strides in. Their feeling was that the service was likely duplicative of the other supportive and rehabilitative mental health services that these clients are eligible for and may indeed be already receiving. They also made an observation that when this service, the specialized maintenance therapy has been around for a while. When it was initially developed, the mental health services that were offered were not nearly as robust and responsive and evidence-based and as thorough as they are today. So it may have had a place and really was serving a much more important function than perhaps it does today, given that the mental health community has so much coordinated efforts around skills training coordinating that with their psychiatric, their medication management. All of that is really done within that framework. So their feeling was that most of the services that were being provided really could be provided within the mental health services.
So, sure.
Yes, this probably is taking more time than everybody thought it was going to, but just one question on the special maintenance therapy. My understanding for the PCA and home care services, regardless of the disability, mental health or otherwise, is to facilitate the person to be able to stay in a community-based living situation. If they have a certain number of compromised living skills, so it's about their habitat and their living situation outside of a more structured and more expensive care system. Whereas the special maintenance therapy, which is occupational therapy, may be related to, and this is my question, creating a skill set to move a person, for example, who has schizophrenia or has some other kind of mental illness disability, to learn basic skills of getting someplace on time, learning how to interact with occupational therapy so that they can be integrated into a working situation. And I'm not certain if that's what special maintenance therapy is, that you can count on that being covered by home care services. That would be my question. If we're losing something here that, not that you don't want to control the cost, this is a big growth. It may be associated with some other programs that we have that are moving people into community-based workplaces or work, asking people to make more contributions to their ongoing costs. I don't know what the relationship is, but sometimes growth in these programs is related to something that we've cut someplace else. So I'm not sure about that. But that is what I understand, especially maintenance therapy services, especially for the mentally ill, to be involved in order to help them develop some basic socialization capacity to, or basic skills to be in the workplace.
Ms. Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, I don't mean to imply that the services for improving someone's capacity to be at work, to manage behavior, that is the role of the PCA. Those services are the ones that are within the mental health community. There are skills training. There are integration of those types of management services within that aspect. The PCA and the home care are really, if we're talking about the ability to maintain a level of functional status, that typically, and I should point out, we are the only state that has such this type of service. There isn't another state. Medicare does not pay for this service. Typically what would happen in where this service isn't available is the therapist will come to the end of the treatment plan, and as the person reaches a plateau where there doesn't appear to be any progress or any potential yet that they can really make that's measurable and meaningful, then they will use a certain number of sessions to transition off to the caregivers, to what are the different activities, exercises, things that you can do to maintain this level of function. Those are things that a PCA may be trained to do if that's indeed what is necessary for some of these folks.
Okay, well, thank you for this was, I guess, a little bit more extensive than we anticipated, but I appreciate that. It's been helpful. And if there's no other questions, members, I'd like to continue and ask Mr. Leitz to proceed.
I'll just take the next proposal, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Mr. Greenman.
The next proposal is on page 71, and what this proposal does is modify the process for authorizing MA payments when there's a third party involved who may be liable to pay for a portion of the claim or all of the claim for services. And when I say third party, I mean private health insurance, Medicare, some other party that may be liable in one way or another legally to pay for the care. As I mentioned in introducing the last proposal, we pay for approximately 80,000 prior authorizations a year through our fee-for-service system. Often if somebody, and many of those people do have third parties who may be liable, and under our law, the third party is always the primary payer, and so provider needs to go to them first to get the primary payment, and then what's not covered is covered by MA if it's an authorized service. What we're finding is happening somewhat is a provider needs to go through two prior authorizations. If there's a third party involved, they need to get the prior authorization from the third party and then from MA. And what's this? This is creating a cumbersome process, obviously, for the provider, and it's also creating an incentive to just bypass the third party and go directly to MA for the prior authorization, and we would then pick up a bigger share of the cost. What this proposal would do is essentially two things. It would say that before MA would authorize payment, if there's a third party, we do require that the provider show that there was an attempt to get a prior authorization for payment through the third party before bringing the request to MA for authorization for payment. Secondly, what it does is it would allow that if a third party has paid for at least 60% of the cost of a service, we won't require prior authorization through our healthcare programs to cover a service. In other words, if the third party's already picked up a big share of the cost and thinks that it's a medically necessary payment, we won't ask for another prior authorization. That's what this proposal does. The other thing it does is right now we have some rules in place regarding people on MA who pay for that limit the ability of people on MA to pay for services or equipment that isn't medically necessary but that they may want for one reason or another, and we limit their ability to pay for those. And I think those protections were put in place mainly to help the consumer so they're not getting charged for things by their providers that aren't medically necessary, and also to make sure people aren't purchasing, controlled substances and things like that. So what this proposal would also do is take away some of those limitations on the ability of MA clients to go out and buy things with their own money that maybe aren't medically necessary, but that will, you know, maybe like a prosthetic running leg or something instead of the you know, whatever prosthetic MA would pay for if the person wants a special type of equipment or service.
Okay.
All right. The next proposal is on page 72. That deals with the way we pay for our methodology for paying for augmentative and alternative communication equipment. Basically, that's equipment that people to help individuals with that have expressive communication disorders due to a disability, due to things like autism, stroke, multiple sclerosis. These are equipment that help them communicate. We purchase these through the MA program through vendors. And historically, when we first began to set rates for this, we set the rate at the manufacturer's suggested retail price, and that seemed like an appropriate rate to pay when the vendors were actually not the manufacturers; they were actually purchasing them from the manufacturers and then getting them to us. What's happened over time is more and more the manufacturers are the vendors, and obviously they can get things for much cheaper than the manufacturer's suggested retail price. So we felt like we are currently overpaying right now for some of these services. So what we did, since we still do have some vendors who aren't manufacturers, we're setting up a sort of a two-tiered pricing system. Instead of paying the manufacturer's suggested retail price, if the vendor is in fact a manufacturer, we'll pay the suggested retail price minus 20%. And if it's a vendor who's not a manufacturer, we'll pay the invoice price plus 20%. So it's basically setting up a pricing system that reflects the change in who the vendors are, and that produces some savings. Okay. The next proposal is on page, I believe it's on page 73. It's our pharmacy reimbursement proposal. This makes a number of changes to the way we pay for the methods that we use to pay for our prescription drugs through our pharmacy program. The first is that historically when we bought, generally when we, the general method we used to pay for pharmaceuticals is the average wholesale price. And that was a figure or a number that was reported and collected by a national organization and reported to us, and we would use that as our basis for setting rates. And currently, I think, or it has been at this point, the price that we pay is currently average wholesale price minus 15%. What's happened over time is that there's been some litigation around the use of the average wholesale price and some questions about whether it's actually an inflated number or not. And so as a result, the national organization that we get that information from is no longer going to publish that average wholesale price. So we need another method or a benchmark on which to set our rates. And we've chosen to use the wholesale acquisition cost. So the first change in this proposal would just essentially allow us to use the wholesale acquisition cost plus 2%. And that setting it at that level would essentially maintain the current prescription drug reimbursement as we currently provide. So it doesn't affect any savings or costs. It just sets it at the same level, but it just uses a different benchmark. The second piece of this proposal has to do with how we pay for drugs that are administered in an office setting. There's a lot of complications around the way we set prices for prescription drugs that have kind of evolved over time. Right now, when there's an office-administered drug, we pay for the average sales price, which is which is data that's reported only on drugs purchased administered in offices. What we do is the current rate in Minnesota is the average sales price plus 6%, unless there is no average sales price that's being reported. Usually that happens when there's a new drug on the market. Currently what we do is we pay the average wholesale price minus 5% if there is no drug on the market. That we found is provides significant profit for the office office-administered drugs, and what we found is that that's also creating an incentive in some cases for pharmacies to maybe choose a more expensive new drug that doesn't have an average wholesale or average an average sales price. So at this point, what we're planning to do is to modify that as well. In cases where there isn't an average sales price on a drug, we'll instead use the wholesale acquisition cost to pay for the drug, and that we expect to produce some savings. That's part of this proposal. The last piece is has to do with how we pay for hemophilia blood factor products. Right now, we've set a rate for that we pay the average wholesale price minus 30%, and we found that there are a lot of different blood factor products out there, and they can be set at different rates. And so rather than set one rate for them, what this proposal would do would allow the state to go out and determine what a reasonable price is to pay on a product-by-product basis and come up with that as a way to pay for those types of products. So those are the three ways we're changing the way we're paying for our pharmaceuticals. The last piece of what we're doing here is has to do with the Affordable Care Act and the requirement in that we collect drug rebates on drugs purchased through managed care organizations. In the past, we've only collected rebates on fee-for-service drugs. We anticipate that with this new requirement, we're going to need an additional FTE to administer the rebates, to deal with the invoicing and dispute resolution processes, because one of the big pieces where we're going to be paying for this and trying to collect rebates is on office-administered drugs. And that's where they tend to be more controversy in terms of paying the rebates. And we assume that our pharmacy unit does not have the staffing to collect that rebate and to administer the rebates. And so that one piece of this is to add an FTE for that. And that partially offsets the savings, but this proposal does still result in a net savings to the state.
Members, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, one quick question about that. It seems to me that if the person, the full-time equivalent, is simply to be out collecting drug rebates, and I know it may be complicated and big fights on some of them, still seems to me you'd have fairly large savings from that if we're not collecting them at all right now. Where is that? I mean, how much of the savings is that supposed to be showing up in?
Senator Marty, Mr. Chair, the savings are in the forecast.
What does that mean?
How much?
Sorry, that means that when Mr. Hoffman does his budget forecast for February and upcoming years, he's already calculated what that savings will be.
Mr. Chairman, can we get an estimate of what that is doing to the forecast?
We have somebody coming up.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Sarah Drake. I'm the Pharmacy Program Manager at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. The managed care drug rebates piece that we intend to begin collecting retroactively back to March of 2010, we anticipate that we'll bring somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 million into the department, about $75 to $100 million of which would be state share. We don't know yet if this managed care rebate is going to be a net positive or negative for the department, because it depends on what needs to be negotiated with the managed care plans in terms of adjustments to their capitation rates. But it is a significant amount of dollars coming in on rebate. Our concern is that my existing rebate staff is unable to handle the increase in volume in rebate, so we need an additional person. That's what we did instead of
requiring them to go. Senator Brooker, do you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, in regard to hemophiliac blood products, you know, when we set the rate at 30% below the average wholesale price, it was because that was the 340B price. It was the cheapest price anybody was getting those products at in the state of Minnesota. And we didn't say you had to get it from a 340B provider if another provider wanted to meet the 340B price. So how is it that we can negotiate and get lower prices than the 340B price on hemophilia products?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund. My understanding is that these products are attainable at lower than AWP minus 30 at this time. The pharmaceutical market continues to change. A lot of these products are being dispensed by mail order, hemophilia specialty pharmacies now, as well as the 340B treatment centers. And what we've seen from data we've gotten from the providers that will share data with us, as well as other state Medicaid programs, there is a discount that beyond the AWP minus 30 that's available at this time. We're unable to continue using AWP after September because it won't be published.
That. I understand so, that problem.
So rather than doing a conversion to wholesale acquisition for the hemophilia, we're proposing managing them like we manage the rest of our specialty drugs through either a MAC or a specialized discount on a per-product basis. A number of other Medicaids have been successful with that kind of strategy.
Mr. Chairman, just one other question, if I can go back to the physical therapy page. If the pricing of this page doesn't intend to exclude anybody from receiving a first-time service that where it's being requested by a physician, would there be any change to the page then if we exempted services that would be provided during the first week while the prior authorization is pending?
Mr. Leitz, Mr. Greenman.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I imagine there would be some change in the budget page. We'd have to assume that some people would get services. If I'm understanding your question, that some people would get services during that first week who we would maybe not prior authorize, and so there would be some payment for services that wouldn't otherwise get.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Berglund,
Mr. Greenman, I understood your answer to my previous question about what was going to get eliminated was that it wasn't at the beginning that people weren't going to get the service. It was more toward the end because maybe people are getting services up to the cap now and maybe they really don't need it up to the cap. So my question is, if we allowed people who were going to get services to be able to get them during the first week so they're not sitting and waiting for a prior authorization, would that change the fiscal pricing of the page?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, we'll take a look at that. I don't think we can, but we'll take a look at it.
All right. Members, we are going to continue on Friday morning, anticipating starting at 8:30. I'm going to ask Mr. Hoffman if he might join us as well briefly to comment on some of the numbers we talked about earlier on the medical assistance forecast enrollment. And then we would continue with the budget change pages. And thank you for being here this morning. Appreciate your help. And that we are adjourned.